Welcome to another episode of My Weird Prompts, an AI-generated podcast featuring the random prompts of Daniel Rosehill as answered by a revolving cast of friendly AI characters. Join us for deep dives into AI, technology, and whatever other random thing Daniel finds fascinating today. Subscribe on Spotify or your favorite podcatcher. Now, today's episode.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Hey, Herman and Corin, you guys might know that I'm something of a prepper type. Before the Iran-Israel war last summer, I would have said, don't call me a prepper. That's an insult. Because prepping is a loaded term, right? It comes with all this judgment. People imagine preppers, I guess, as going to bug outs, stockpiling, massive amounts of dry tuna for when the apocalypse strikes. And I'm kind of partially making fun of them myself in order to, with tongue in cheek here, because everyone has a different conception of what that means. My own is very focused on what you might call pragmatic, or for me, the type of prepping I found worthwhile, having lived through the 12-day war with Iran and several previous things where the cadence of daily life pretty quickly comes to a halt. And services are disrupted. And I found that my personal priority list is connectivity and power. So that manifests as I own more power banks probably than your average person. I have things like travel routers and a 4G antenna if required to get signal. And the reason, again, is because I found that what is important in these situations that I've lived through is information flow and being able to receive live government news from trusted sources, especially when there's disinformation, as we saw happen actually in this conflict with Iran. But there is a different level of prepping that takes place at the government level and as well as at the business level. I bought a few years ago a book on business continuity planning, which is a really interesting field on the surface. In practicality, I had a friend actually who had considered working in the space, and I told him I just bought this book, and he said, I have to warn you, it's really boring. It sounds very interesting, but it's a lot of details and risk assessments and filling out the form and the almost glamorous exercise of being the hero who makes sure that a major business can survive a hurricane if it hits is very much the kind of 0.001% of the job, and the 99% of the job is all the preparation for that. But there's a parallel track to this that happens at the government level, where we tend to think about prepping for, in this sense, of disaster preparedness in terms of physical infrastructure, things like, as I mentioned, phone lines and electricity supply and backup generators. But there's also a concept of continuity of government, where we have things like ensuring that the leadership of a country has a continuity plan of its own. Something that I found really fascinating from this book that I mentioned is it was talking about government preparedness. And when a crisis strikes in an area, whether it's a hurricane or the outbreak of war, we kind of have this picture in the news. Sometimes it really, that is what happens. You see government leaders huddled around kind of they call it in Hebrew, chamal, chader milchama, literally means a war room. Control room, right? Where it's all these kind of telephones and screens up and what have you. And what the book said is that even that level, the physical control room level, has to have redundancy. It mentioned that you would have governments that actually have redundant operation centers, redundant dispatch centers, everything redundant. So we're not just talking about the basics of electricity supply power, that's just the physical infrastructure. We have redundant workspaces. We have redundant command infrastructure and redundant people. So that's what I'd love to get into today, Herman and Corin, as niche a topic as this is. Continuity planning, the government does. If I were to know where the government had its command center, for argument's sake, and they told me our backup command center is at such and such an address, would I find a literal command center from the movies sitting with the lights off, ready to be activated if required? That's what I'd love to talk about, Herman and Corin. The failover infrastructure, not just for the infrastructure itself, but for the people the workspaces and everything else that goes into redundancy planning at the government level. Over to you, Herman and Corn.
Hey everyone, welcome back to My Weird Prompts. I am Corn, and I'm sitting here in our living room in Jerusalem with my brother.
Herman Poppleberry, at your service. It is a beautiful day outside, but we are about to talk about some pretty dark and deep underground topics.
Yeah, our housemate Daniel sent us a fascinating audio prompt this morning. He was talking about his own preparations for crises, things like power banks and travel routers, but he really wanted us to dive into the big league stuff. We are talking about government continuity planning and failover infrastructure.
Daniel has been on a bit of a pragmatic prepping kick lately. I think living through the various tensions and conflicts we have seen recently has everyone thinking about what happens when the lights go out or the internet stops working. But Daniel is right. There is a whole world of professional continuity planning that goes way beyond having a few extra batteries in your drawer.
It is interesting because we usually think of government as this solid, immovable thing. But as Daniel pointed out, it is actually a collection of people and systems that can be quite fragile. If a major disaster hits a capital city, how does the country keep functioning? Is there really a secret command center with the lights off, just waiting for a button to be pressed?
That is the big question, isn't it? The short answer is yes, but it is way more complex and, in some ways, more mundane than the movies suggest. We are talking about continuity of government, or COG. This is a set of defined procedures that allow a government to continue its essential operations in case of a nuclear war or other catastrophic event.
You have been reading up on this, haven't you? I can see the excitement in your eyes. You love a good bunker story.
Guilty as charged. But it is not just about the bunkers. It is about the architecture of resilience. In the United States, for example, this is governed by things like National Security Presidential Directive 51. It outlines how the executive branch functions during a national essential function crisis. But let us talk about the physical spaces first, because that is what Dana was asking about.
Right, the literal command centers. If we were to walk into one of these backup sites today, what would we actually see?
Well, if you went to a place like Mount Weather in Virginia or Raven Rock in Pennsylvania, you would find something that is very much alive. Raven Rock, which is often called the Underground Pentagon, is located near the Maryland border in Pennsylvania. It is not just a dusty room with some old maps. It is a fully functional 24/7 facility.
Wait, so it is not just sitting there empty? People are actually working there right now?
Exactly. These sites often operate on what they call a warm standby or even hot standby basis. At Raven Rock, there are hundreds of personnel who work there every day to ensure the communication systems are patched, the databases are synced, and the life support systems are humming. If you wait until the crisis happens to turn the lights on, you have already lost. You need to know that the air filtration works and the secure lines to the nuclear silos are active before the sirens go off.
That makes sense from a technical standpoint. If you have a massive failover server for a website, you don't just leave it unplugged until the main site crashes. You keep it mirrored. But doing that for an entire government seems like an incredible logistical burden.
It is massive. And it is not just one site. There is a whole web of them. You have Mount Weather, which is managed by the Federal Emergency Management Agency, and then you have various Raven Rock-style sites for the military. Even the Federal Reserve has high security facilities where they can manage the national economy if Washington is compromised. The goal is redundancy at every layer.
I'm curious about the human element Daniel mentioned. He talked about redundant personnel. Does that mean there are literally backup people for high-level officials who just sit around waiting for their turn?
It is not quite like a bench in a football game, but it is close. This is where the concept of the designated survivor comes in, which many people know from the television show. During major events like the State of the Union address, one cabinet member is kept at a secure, undisclosed location so that if the entire leadership is wiped out, there is someone with legal authority to take over.
But that is just for one night. What about the day-to-day?
On a day-to-day basis, it is about the order of succession. Every department has a list. If the secretary is gone, the deputy takes over. If the deputy is gone, the undersecretary takes over. But the redundant personnel Daniel mentioned often refers to the staff who are pre-assigned to the emergency relocation sites. These people have emergency employee status. They know that in a crisis, they don't go home to their families. They report to a specific bunker or a mobile command post.
That sounds incredibly stressful. Imagine being told that if the world starts ending, your job is to leave everyone you love and go sit in a hole in Pennsylvania to make sure the Department of Agriculture still functions.
It is a grim reality of the job. But from a systems perspective, it is the only way to ensure the state doesn't just evaporate. In these bunkers, a huge part of the work is maintaining the essential records. These are the legal documents, the land deeds, the social security databases, and the treaties that define the country. If those are destroyed, you don't have a country anymore, you just have a group of people in the woods.
So, it is as much a digital and paper backup as it is a physical one. But let us get into the tech side. Daniel is a tech guy. He has his antennas and routers. What kind of failover infrastructure are we talking about at the government level? I assume they aren't just using a standard fiber optic line.
Oh, definitely not. They use what is called hardened infrastructure. One of the biggest threats to a command center isn't just a physical bomb, but an electromagnetic pulse, or EMP. A nuclear blast in the atmosphere could fry every unshielded circuit for hundreds of miles. So, these command centers are basically giant Faraday cages.
For those who might have forgotten their high school physics, a Faraday cage is an enclosure used to block electromagnetic fields, right?
Exactly. The walls are often lined with copper or steel, and every wire coming into the building has to go through specialized surge protectors that can react in nanoseconds. They also have their own independent power grids. We are talking about massive diesel generators with enough fuel to last for months. And sometimes, even small modular nuclear reactors have been proposed for these types of sites.
What about the actual communication? If the internet goes down, how do these bunkers talk to each other?
This is where it gets really cool. They use a variety of out-of-band communication methods. There is the Minimum Essential Emergency Communications Network, which uses very low-frequency radio waves. These waves can actually travel through the earth and water, which is how they talk to submarines. They are slow, like old-school dial-up or even slower, but they are nearly impossible to jam or destroy.
That is fascinating. It is like they are reverting to older tech because the new tech is too fragile.
In many ways, yes. They also use hardened satellite links. There is a system called the Global Aircrew Strategic Network Terminals, or Global ASNT, which is designed to provide secure, EMP-protected communications to nuclear command and control teams. It is all about having a path for the data that doesn't rely on the public internet or the standard cellular grid.
It makes me think about Daniel's point about disinformation. In a crisis, the first thing that happens is people lose access to the truth. If the government can't talk to the people, or even to its own regional offices, the vacuum gets filled by rumors and panic.
That is exactly why Continuity of Operations, or COOP, is so focused on communication. It is not just about the president being able to launch missiles. It is about the local governor being able to tell people where the clean water is. In the United States, there is the Integrated Public Alert and Warning System. It is designed to be extremely resilient, using multiple pathways to get messages to your phone, your radio, and even digital billboards.
I remember we touched on some of the infrastructure stuff in our earlier episodes, but this is a whole different scale. It is not just about moving bits efficiently. It is about moving them when the world is literally on fire.
Right? And the failover isn't just a switch you flip, it is a constant process of testing. They run these massive exercises, like the recurring Eagle Horizon drills, where they actually move thousands of people to these backup sites to see if they can actually do their jobs there. They find things like, oh, the secure login for the Treasury database doesn't work from this IP address, or we don't have enough bunk beds for the overnight shift.
It is the boring part of business continuity that Daniel's friend mentioned. The risk assessments, the forms, the checklists. It is not cinematic until it is the only thing standing between order and total collapse.
Exactly. And that brings up an interesting point about the niche part of this. There is a concept called devolution. If the primary command center is gone and the secondary one is also hit, the authority devolves to a completely different geographic region. Suddenly, a regional office in Denver or St. Teen, Louis might become the temporary capital of the country. They have devolution kits, which are basically government in a box with all the necessary codes, keys, and documents.
That is a wild thought. The center of power shifting to a random office building in the Midwest. But let us bring this back to a more personal scale. Daniel calls himself a pragmatic prepper. Most of our listeners aren't going to build a Faraday-shielded bunker in their backyard. What are the second-order effects of this government planning that we can actually use?
I think the biggest takeaway is the concept of resilience over efficiency. In our modern world, we optimize for efficiency. Just-in-time delivery, lean staffing, everything connected to one cloud provider. But government continuity is the opposite. It is inefficient because it is redundant.
Right. Having two of everything is twice as expensive, but it is the only way to be resilient.
Exactly. For an individual, that might mean having a physical map in your car instead of just relying on GPS. It might mean having a landline or a satellite-based emergency communicator. It is about identifying your single points of failure. If your entire life requires a specific smartphone and a specific cellular tower to function, you are very fragile.
I also think about the trusted sources, Daniel mentioned. In a crisis, the infrastructure of truth is just as important as the infrastructure of power. If you don't have a plan for how you will get verified information when the social media apps are down, you are going to be in trouble.
That is a great point. One of the things governments do is maintain high power, AM radio stations. AM signals can travel much further than FM, especially at night. In a total blackout, a simple battery-powered radio might be your only link to the outside world. That is a piece of failover infrastructure that is accessible to everyone.
It is funny how we have all this high-tech stuff, but in the end, it comes back to radio waves and physical paper.
It really does. There is a certain beauty in the robustness of older technology, but don't get me wrong, the modern stuff is incredible. The way they can now mirror entire data centers across continents in real time is something that wasn't possible 20 years ago. The cloud has actually made government continuity easier in some ways, because the data isn't tied to a single physical hard drive in a basement in DC.
But isn't that a double-edged sword? If the cloud provider goes down, then everyone's redundant systems go down at once?
You are hitting on a major debate in the world of BCP right now. We call it concentration risk. If the Department of Defense, the Treasury, and the local hospital all use the same cloud provider, a single technical glitch or a cyber attack on that provider becomes a national security event. That is why the most advanced continuity plans actually require multi-cloud or hybrid cloud strategies where data is mirrored across completely different infrastructures.
This is making me think about our house, Herman. Daniel has his routers, and you have your books. But do we have a continuity plan for my weird prompts? What happens if our local ISP goes down?
Well, we have Daniel's travel routers. But honestly, the fact that we host our RSS feed on a decentralized platform is a small form of continuity planning. Our listeners on Spotify and at myweirdprompts.com can still find us even if one server somewhere has a bad day.
True. But maybe we should get a Faraday cage for our microphones, just in case.
I'll get right on that. But seriously, the boring part that Daniel's friend mentioned is actually the most important part. It is the what-if games we play. What if the power is out for 3 days? What if the water isn't running? What if we can't get to the grocery store? Just having that conversation puts you ahead of 90% of the population.
It is about mental failover. If you have already thought through the scenario, you won't panic when it happens. Your brain has a warm standby plan ready to go.
I love that. Mental failover. That should be the title of our next training manual. But back to Daniel's question about the command centers. There is one more thing that most people don't realize. These sites aren't just for the big end of the world stuff. They are used for much more common things, like major hurricanes or even large-scale cyber attacks. They are multi-hazard facilities.
So they get activated more often than we think.
Oh, all the time. During the early days of the pandemic in 2020, many of these continuity plans were activated, not because of a bomb, but because the primary workspaces were no longer safe for people to be in. They had to devolve operations to home offices and secondary sites. That was the biggest real-world test of COG and COOP in history.
And how did it go?
It was a mixed bag. The digital infrastructure held up surprisingly well, but the human element, the redundant personnel, struggled with the transition. It turns out that even with all the planning in the world, humans are still the most unpredictable part of the system. We get tired, we get sick, and we worry about our families.
Which brings us back to Daniel's priority, information flow. If people know what is happening, they are much more likely to stay calm and follow the plan. Disinformation thrives in silence.
Exactly. That is why the most important part of any command center isn't the big screens or the fancy maps. It is the broadcast booth. The ability to speak to the nation and say, "We are still here, the system is working, and here is what you need to do."
It is a fascinating look into a world most of us will never see, and hopefully, we will never have to see it in action. But it is comforting to know that there are people whose entire job is to think about the worst-case scenario, so we don't have to.
It is a strange, niche profession, but I'm glad they are doing it. And I'm glad Daniel sent us this prompt. It is a good reminder to check our own failover systems, even if it is just making sure the flashlights have fresh batteries.
Well, I think we have gone pretty deep into the bunker today. Before we wrap up, I want to remind everyone that if you are enjoying these deep dives, please leave us a review on your podcast app or on Spotify. It really helps the show reach more curious minds like yours.
And you can always find our full archive and the contact form at myweirdprompts.com. We love hearing from you, and we love the weird questions you send our way.
Any final thoughts on the command centers, Herman?
Just one. If you ever find yourself in a situation where you are looking for a backup command center, you have probably had a very bad day, so maybe just stick to having a good power bank and a solid radio for now.
Sage advice from Herman Poppleberry. Thanks for listening to My Weird Prompts. We will be back next week with another exploration of the strange and the technical.
Stay curious and stay prepared.
See you next time.
Bye, everyone.
So, Armin, about that Faraday cage, do you think we can make one out of old pizza boxes and aluminum foil?
I mean, theoretically, if the foil is thick enough and you seal the seams perfectly, but I think Daniel might object to us covering the living room in tinfoil.
Worth a shot. I'll go get the tape.
Wait, no, let's at least use the heavy-duty stuff.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks for listening. Find us on Spotify and at myweirdprompts.com. See you later.
Goodbye.
This episode was generated using Gemini Flash 3. Text-to-speech engine was Chatterbox Turbo.
Thanks for listening to another episode of My Weird Prompts, an AI-generated podcast featuring Daniel Rosehill's AI prompts, as answered by a revolving cast of friendly AI characters including me, Cornelius the Sloth. Subscribe on Spotify or visit myweirdprompts.com.